When I say it's not a phenomena, I said there's not something going on here that is the belief. It's objective phenomena in the sense that it's a fact. And very clearly, if I'm sitting here saying the lion is dangerous, you, when you say he believes the lion is dangerous, are certainly not saying anything false. So it's a factual statement there. But it's a fact that doesn't correspond to a second phenomena out here, not a different one from when I say the lion is dangerous. There's only that phenomena. All of these are other ways of talking about it, and they don't correspond to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 other phenomena. And so what there is to be studied is identified here and not in any special way by any of these. No. You see, what? Just think of what you would have to do to study beliefs. What you would have to do is study what I took to be knowledge, and then you would call it a belief, and then that's what you would study. But how would that differ from studying cases of knowledge? At a later time, when we get into status notions, I'm going to say these are status assignments, not descriptions. It's like saying something is true or false. That's not a description. It's a way of categorizing it and giving it a particular place. But it isn't a description. And that's part of the force of saying they're not separate phenomena. They're ways of evaluating something. Well, no. What they're talking about is this kind of thing. One part of me felt this way, another part of me felt that way. One part of me thought this, another part of me knew that this was the case. I can't recall any particular case of therapist talking that way that didn't resolve to reasons pro and con. See, if I feel X and I feel Y, it means that I have this reason to behave on the basis of X and I have this other reason to behave on the basis of Y. And they may be in direct conflict. Well, therapists don't tend to talk in terms of reason. They tend to talk in terms of feelings. And so to get at the same facts that we get at this way, they talk about conflicting feelings or oneself being broken up into parts which are inclined in different ways or feel differently or believe differently or literally are different people. What's hard to interpret, if somebody says, well, you're divided into three people, that sounds objective. And if you took that seriously, you would ask, where are they? It turns out that they're not any more than id, ego, and superego are three inner people. They are three ways of functioning. And adult, parent, child are going to turn out to be three ways of functioning, not three people. And three ways of functioning, the main reason for distinguishing them is the implications for behavior. If you're functioning in the first way, you would do one thing. If you were functioning in the second way, you would do something else. That's exactly what the language of reasons does. If you were acting on this reason, you choose this behavior. If you're acting on this one, you choose that.
So you don't fall into that trap by saying, say, the critic is in terms of the observer describer, and the observer describer in terms of the actor.
Not in terms of, is a special case of. So you don't have to break the actor up into three things, an actor, observer, critic.
So the case where
we're all one person? Yeah. See, they're compatible with one another, and that's why you don't have to split them up in order to take advantage of the differences. You don't have to call them parent, adult, child, and say these are three different ego states. You don't have to call them id, ego, superego, and say there are three topologically different parts of your mental structure.
Okay.
Again, that's one of the virtues of dealing with facts, is that you don't have to invent structures or processes every time you have a different kind of fact. Okay, as I say, this whole thing is kind of a digression from discussion of emotions, and you can see why some of these terms are emotion terms. And here again, because some of these terms are emotion terms, recall we were diagnosing either last time or before, why there is traditionally a dichotomy between emotional and intellectual, or emotional and rational, or now that I think of it, emotional and objective. Well, here's the objective statement, and here is the emotional. And in this framework, emotion does contrast with objective.
When two observers simply disagree rather than one being non-committal and the other being committal, is that,
you know, if he says, no, the lion wasn't dangerous,
right,
then he's not being non-committal. Yeah.
And that was, you would say that was an objective disagreement.
No, I just say that was a disagreement.
Talking objective ways.
Yeah. It's a disagreement about the facts because they are both talking objective language. If one person says talks this way and another person talks that way, they don't disagree. And they can't. It's only if both of them talk this way that they can disagree. Or if both of them talk this way, they disagree. But not if one does one and the other does the other. No. No, one of these is he felt afraid.
Okay, right. But is that the reason why he considered it an emotional question?
No, afraid is, on the face of it, an emotional term.
Right.
No, I'm not. Remember, this is not emotional, this isn't. That's why I called it a digression, and then commented that one reason that I thought of bringing it up here is that some of the terms that you do use that are subjective are emotional terms, but not all of them. Now, the next move, I think, ought to be to the relationship change formula. Refer back to the developmental schema and the two units here. The one unit one for explaining behavior, unit two for explaining the acquisition of personal characteristics. Remember that each one of these has a three-way logical connection. This one has these three things, this one has these three. Now, with the relationship formula, what we saw is that there is an alternative to here, to accounting for behavior on the basis of personal characteristics and circumstances. Instead, we combined these two and talked about relationship. So the relationship formula is a different way of dealing with this problem, namely explaining behavior. And it's an alternative to saying personal characteristics plus circumstances lead to behavior. In place of that, given a relationship, behavior will be an expression of it unless. Now, the relationship change formula is the alternative to this. So that by the time we have both the relationship formula and the change formula, we have an alternative to the developmental schema. Now, in our terms, we developed this from critic and this one from observer. You'll see later on that we need both formulations in order to do a good job of examining the several theories that we're going to examine, because some of the theories are couched in this pattern and others are couched in the relationship pattern. So we would need to go through both of these anyhow. But for us, it's an issue of the concept of person and behavior expanded or articulated for the benefit of critic versus for the benefit of observer.
Why would the observer not want to use the pair of concepts?
He's, well, what I said was you never have access to all of these or all of these, and yet that's what, from the critic standpoint, is the only rigorous formulation. You need all the personal characteristics and all of the circumstances in order to account rigorously for the behavior. Now, an observer will never have all of these and all of these. But that's why he has a relationship formula with an unless clause. And the unless clause is the formal recognition that there may be something here that he's missing and that will account for why the behavior isn't an expression. So there's a qualification for the observer carried by the unless clause that is not there for the critic. For the critic, this is a perfectly tight relation. For the observer, he uses this, which is the kind of thing that he has access to, with a qualification. It says, unless some of these other conditions are met. And then, if they are, as an observer, he can hope to establish them too. So it's just the fact that observers do not have exhaustive information that makes this rigorous formula not that usable for observers. And so it's possible to reformulate things and put it this way, and these are the terms in which one most often, as an observer, operates. So it's still possible to do something of the sort with this. If you know some of a person's characteristics, you can have expectations based on those, but then you'll have the unless clauses also. See, for example, if I know that he's a misanthrope and that he's hostile to boot, then I'll have certain expectations which may be violated. But if that's all I know of him, you see, I have in mind that he may have other characteristics that will compensate for that. And since I'm not taking them into account, I have to introduce unless clauses. So if he's that kind of person, he'll act that way unless. So you can do it with these, but most often I think we use this. Okay, now the relationship change formula is a limited replacement for this. It in fact corresponds more to Maxim 7 than to Maxim 8, namely changes that are acquired by learning, rather than changes that are acquired by surgery or other non-learning type things. In this case, we're talking about changes in relationship that are acquired by through interaction. And clearly, not every change of relationship is acquired by interaction. Okay, now the phrasing of the formula requires some notation. You have about six givens and then a conclusion. And it's in paragraph 11, I'm pretty sure. The first condition is that there is a certain relationship between A and G. And we introduce a notation for behavior that would be an expression of that relationship. Now we introduce a new relationship that is not the same as this one, and notation for behavior that's an expression of that. So what we have is a contrast between two relations that are different and the corresponding behaviors that express each one. That's all that this notation does. And now finally, you have five ifs. If this relation exists, and this behavior expresses that relation, and this other relation is not the same as this, and this is the kind of behavior that would express, that would not express this, and this is the behavior that occurs, then. The relationship changes in a certain direction, namely, becomes more like this one. This relation becomes more like that one. Notice here, it's all qualitative. There is no metric. You don't say how fast it changes. You don't say what increments. You don't say that it ever necessarily reaches this. All you say is that it changes in this direction. Now, there's a couple of good paradigm examples of this kind of change. And the one that I think is fairly standard is suppose that R and R prime is either one of these. It's reasonably clear that behavior that expresses these relationships is not the behavior that expresses that relationship. So consider the case where two people have that relationship, namely they are strangers. And yet the behavior that occurs is trusting behavior. Remember, the paradigm case of behavior is that it's successful. So let's introduce explicitly that this behavior is successful. So what happens is that between two strangers, one of them engages in trusting or friendly behavior, and it does not go wrong. It succeeds. Well, that behavior violates this relation which they have. It would be an expression of this relation, but they don't have that relation. And when that happens, this relation of stranger changes in the direction of friend. And typically, that's how you become friends with somebody that you start out strangers with, is that you don't regard them just as strangers. They are potential friends. Something else is in the picture. And so you behave in a way that doesn't merely express the fact that you're a stranger. And so you behave in friendly or trusting ways. And unless that fails, your succeeding in treating this person as a friend leads your relation with him to change in the direction of being a friend. And eventually, you are friends. Now, conversely, suppose that we just reverse these, that R is that you're friends with the other person, And our prime is that you're a stranger or, let's say, enemy. You're friends with a person, and yet, lo and behold, he does something that is not an expression of friendship. He lets you down. He betrays your confidence or something. Well, when that happens, your relation of friend changes in the direction of stranger or enemy. And if he does that enough, you stop being friends. And you are then back to being strangers or to being enemies or something else.
And the relationship change formula is an expression of condition A in the four unlesses.
Most likely there's some other relation that you're acting on when you do this, but it needn't be. It could be any of the others.
He's lost his glasses and takes a stranger for a friend.
Right.
And buys him a cup of coffee.
Right. As a matter of fact, there's some classic fairy tales or folklore based on just that, where, as a matter of fact, now that I think of it, there are some social psychology experiments based on that. Where, you know, I take you aside and say, hey, you're going to be working with somebody who really likes you. And so I misinform you about the relation between you. And then you start acting in terms of that relation. Lo and behold, at the end, you wind up liking each other better than another group in which I said, this guy doesn't like it. So in principle, all of the four unless clauses are potentially available for explaining how come a behavior of this sort could occur, given that you know this relation.
So, yeah, I see. Because it would imply future action. So that even if A did it mistakenly.
If he's successful, what he's found out is that he can do that with this guy, and so he is more like a friend. So the critical condition is that it succeeds rather than fails.
Yeah, about the case where it looks as if one of them failed.
Well, it depends on what happens. See, saying that it fails doesn't say what does happen. And if what happens expresses another relationship, then you would expect the relation to change in the direction of that one. See, if there's a third one, such that what happens when the failure occurs is an expression of this relation, then what you would expect is. As a matter of fact, look, take just these. Suppose you start strangers, you make a friendly move, and you get your head chopped off, your relation will move in this direction. So, as I say, it all depends on what does happen when you don't succeed in carrying off that behavior.
Otherwise, you're still in the scope of the relationship going on. Mm-hmm.
Right. Notice that the occurrence of this behavior here does not violate the relationship formula. It just means that one of the unless clauses is applicable. Because what you had is a case where you had a relation and the behavior wasn't an expression of it. And so one of those four unless clauses is going to be applicable. Yeah, because, see, this is simply a special application of the relationship formula itself. And the relationship formula, as we developed it, is the kind of thing that an observer would need because it is something that you can use when you don't have a lot of facts available. And that's the position observers are always in. Well, remember that one of those unless clauses say A doesn't know, recognize the relation for what it is. So if he doesn't, then he could be acting on a mistaken notion of what the relationship is.
Well,
so it doesn't have to be real.
He could recognize the relation for what it is. That guy's a stranger. Then he could say, well, I'm going to act as if he were my friend.
then you have to be seeing him as something other than just a stranger.
Well, that doesn't seem to necessarily be the case.
A potential friend, maybe, or something like that, but not just a stranger.
Well, it seems like you could recognize it and act on another relationship with the idea in mind that you intend
that's right.
for that relationship.
That's right. That's why I say you see him as a potential friend. And either if you want to make friends, that's reason enough. Or you have other relationships with him, like you work in the same place or something that would, for which this behavior, this one, is an expression. But since it's also an expression of this, merely cooperating with somebody that you work with is likely to make you friends with him eventually.
Well, the problem, then maybe I misunderstand the notion of relationship, because if you've never met somebody, then it seems that your relationship is stranger.
Well, that's at least one relationship that you're guaranteed. That doesn't say that there are not others.
Oh, so your relationship...
Somebody you never met before could be a threat to you.
Okay, so it could be potential threat, potential friend.
Yeah.
And therefore, to act as a friend would be an expression of the relationship of potential friend.
Yeah. You know, somebody that you could make friends with. And it's the negatives that make that plausible. Namely, that if you knew for sure that he was somebody you couldn't make friends with, why would you even make that move?
Can it be more than one dimension? In other words, could there be many, could there be R prime or double prime or triple prime, and the expression of the behavior could be applicable to more than one relationship?
Right. That's part of why there's nothing further by way of metric or anything else here. You could have this behavior be the expression of four relations, and this one would move in the direction of all four. Yeah. Or you could analyze a relation into components and say, when this one moves in the direction of this one, it only moves along one component. That would be an empirical possibility. Yeah. You see, if somebody acts in a friendly way, even if he doesn't feel friendly, you're likely to treat him in a friendly way in return and successfully, and you may become friends, even though he didn't mean it to begin with.
So that's something the observer is using to qualify his understanding of the relationship, is his knowledge of the style that he's using. If friendliness was a trait of the person, regardless of the relationship.
Yeah, the difference will show up in which unless clause the observer uses to account for it. In the one case, he'll say, well, this other guy was friendly, so he made this friendly move, which expressed his ID characteristic, and the other person reacted, and so it was successful, and that's how they got started. Or he can say, this guy happens to have a friendly style, and this other guy mistook it for a friendly behavior, and responded, and it happened to be successful, and that's how they got started. And those are alternative accounts of how they came to be friends. That's right. Right. Well, you stand in a different relation to somebody from your hometown that you meet in Paris than you do with the same person when you meet them here. It's a different relation between. You know, it's like being castaways on a raft or, you know, something on that order. You're in the same boat together. Whereas here, you know, it's something quite otherwise. It can come via expectation, but doesn't have to.
So whether the outcome is something good or positive.
Now see, if you have an expectation of what's going to happen, that will almost certainly affect what happens. But you can move from stranger to friend without having any such expectation. By the way, expectation is another one of our list of subjective terms. And say he expected the lion to eat him or something like that. No, I said the relation will change.
Okay.
What?
I thought you said expect. It sounded like something.
Well, I said that if I have expectations about how that relation is going to change, for example, if I expect that eventually we'll be friends, that will make a difference in how it's likely to go. We're much more likely to become friends if I start out with that kind of expectation. But I also said that you can arrive there without either having that expectation. So the expectation is not necessary, but if it's present, it will usually have some influence.
Perhaps I'm confusing the last question. Are you is the statement from the relationship change formula that given those five things, is likely that R will change the direction of our function?
The formula says this. Oh. Come back to our original paradigm for the relationship formula. Remember I said that you have a law that says some objects will move in the direction of an applied force. You take an object and you apply a force that way, you expect it to go that way. Now the laws of motion don't talk about expectation. They just say it will go that way. But if you as an observer are using that law, then you will expect that the phenomena will follow that law. That's how expectation comes in. So when you have a law stated objectively and you're using it, you expect that the phenomena will correspond. And that's why when you apply this known force, you expect it to move that way, and so you're surprised when it goes down. But then you just reapply it and say there must be another force. In the same way, you see, if you expect that relation to change because of this, and it doesn't, or it changes in some other direction, you say, aha, there was some other relation operating, or something of that sort. And you make up a new account that will fit the facts using the same formula. And then you can check, hopefully, whether your new account is correct. Because if you postulate another relationship that would account for the new behavior, you can also look for other evidence of that relationship. Yeah. Well, okay. The relationship change formula, then, is how one acquires new relationships based on exercising or expressing one's old relationships. And that's the analog of acquiring new personal characteristics by acting in ways that express your old personal characteristics. But you can see, as I say, that that's not the only way to acquire new relationships. See, clearly, somebody may become a danger to me without my ever having interacted with him at all. So I can acquire relationships in other ways than that change formula. Oh, well, that's the point, that the relationship formula says that if you have the relationship, you will act in a way that expresses it unless. This one says what happens when you have a relation and you act in a way that doesn't relate. And that's why I say that in this case, one of the unless clauses in the relationship formula will be applicable. That means, for example, that you have a different relationship that you're acting on, and it's that one that's being expressed in your behavior. You can have a number of relationships with the same person. And if one takes priority and you act on it, you may be violating another one of the relations you have with that person. And that's one of the ways that you can get something that fits this, that you have a relation and you act in a way that violates. So the unless clauses in the relationship formula tell you what are the conditions under which you could get the relationship change formula.
You said that the relationship change formula
would
primarily be used for changes which occur in the
Well, as I say, clearly somebody could become a danger to me just by walking into the room with a gun and pointing it at me. And I would not have acquired that relation by any kind of interaction with him. So not all relationships are gotten by interactions any more than not all personal characteristics are acquired by learning. Because remember, relationships mean circumstances, and they can change from either end. If my circumstances change, I don't have to change in order to have a different set of relations. Conversely, if I change, my circumstances don't have to change in order for me to have a new set of relations. So you can change on either way. And the change formula, you see, is a limited set of ways of getting a changed relation. But it's the change that as psychologists we're primarily interested in, namely the changes that come through interaction. It's the kind of change, for example, that a therapist would be interested in, because interaction is one of the ways that he hopes to produce change. Any questions about the formula as such, or how it works, its relation to the relationship formula? If not, let me pick up some other loose ends here. Before we do that, let's come back . Recall now that we've gone over this AOC diagram and we've developed two things here. We developed this, then went on to this, then came back to this. So we've got two things for observers. One, forms of description, and two, the relationship formula. One thing for critic, namely maxims. And two aspects of the notion of person behaving, namely the notion of person and the notion of behavior. And these two are connected to one another in that personal characteristics are derived from types of behavior and pattern of occurrence. Now I want to take from here two important forms of description and connect them up. And the first one is deliberate action. In which you're using and the second is social practice. Both of these, deliberate action and social practice, were forms of description. And in developing the social practice description, all we did was something like this, namely to show that you could string actions together and said with some additional maneuvering, this will get you patterns of social behavior. Now, you can start from there and introduce additional maneuvers, or you can start from a very different place and get to the same endpoint. And in fact, where we have started with the description of social behavior is not this form of description as developed, but from the transition rules, which are your fourth or fifth appendix. Transition rules that connect object, process, event, and state of affairs. Now, take the notion of process. All visible behavior, all patterns of social behavior will be processes. There are things that go on through time, they last a certain period of time, they have all of the characteristics of a process. Technical question is, what do you have to specify to distinguish one process from another. You should recognize that as the mark of a parametric analysis. How do processes differ from one another or resemble one another? Connects directly to what do you have to specify about a given process or kind of process to distinguish it from other processes or kinds. Now, it's when you tackle that question, how do you represent a given process or a kind of process, that you're into the notion of descriptive formats, and here specifically of a process description. What do you have to specify a process? And we have a conventional diagram which simply represents a sequence of some sort, and the sequence is called stages. And options that is, in general, there is more than one way of doing the same thing, namely a stage in the process. For a familiar example that fits this kind of representation, think of a chess game and think of this as the sequence of white moves, black moves, etc. And then think of the options that white has for making his first move. There's some fair number of those. And the options that black has for making his, and then the options that white has for making second move, and so forth. Now, these specifications of this sort give you a very crude picture, but sometimes that's all you need. Now, in order to get a more refined picture, you have to specify further things. The most helpful thing for elements, individuals, and eligibilities is to think of a drama, say Hamlet. And then the elements will correspond to the different roles in the play. For example, Hamlet would be one such. The skull would be another such. So all of the props, all of the roles would be elements. Individuals are historical individuals, like John Doe, the man who plays Hamlet. So individuals are identified by name, number, or other identifying device. And the eligibilities are what connect individuals to elements. A given individual may play Hamlet, but he may also play the spear bearer in one of the scenes where Hamlet doesn't appear. So there's not necessarily a one-to-one connection between individuals and roles or elements. So the eligibility specify which individuals can operate in which way. Now, if you take a very different sort of example, like a motor that's running, and think of the functions of the carburetor and the pistons and the cylinders. Clearly, the things that serve as carburetor is not something that could also serve as the piston. In contrast, your left front tire could just as easily be your right front tire. You could switch it around. So eligibilities are what connect the ingredients, the individuals, and the roles or the kind of function or the way that they enter into the process. No, that's why I mentioned the skull. All of the props in the play, furniture, tables, chairs, etc., are simply elements. Okay, now specifying these kinds of things gets you a more refined picture of the process. Now, in addition, you have contingencies. And of these, there are two kinds. And they are co-occurrence contingencies and attributional contingencies. The co-occurrence contingencies simply specify that if certain options are selected at some point, then certain options elsewhere are ruled out. And the best example for this is the chess game. If white makes a particular first move and black a particular second move, then, or a particular first move, the second move of white is limited, and the second move of black is limited by virtue of their having made the first moves that they did. So in general, how things go in one way in a process makes a difference in how things can go at other points in the process. Now, co-occurrence contingencies are not restricted to contingencies that go forward in time. They can connect anything to anything. You can have contingencies that say, if this is the way you end, then the third one must have been this one and none other. So you can connect in any order, in any pattern. Okay, now this gives a, you can see, a finer structure than if it were the case that any one of these and any one of these and any one of these and any one of these could take place. Chess wouldn't be the game it is if that were so.
Are the options within the stages mutually exclusive?
Yeah. Each one of these is one of the ways that this could happen. And so either this one occurs or this or this or that.
There's no way that them being in a certain sort of ex post facto different, but on occurrence are different.
How do you mean ex post facto?
Well, if somebody's describing it back, they could have said
No, what you can have is more than one description of a given option. And if you started out with description one, you may change to description two after the fact.
That's what I was thinking
right.
In terms of descriptions rather than...
Right, but then you wouldn't call them different options. Yeah. You know, attributional contingencies say that some of the individuals have to have certain characteristics in order to be eligible to serve as particular elements. And here the Hamlet example is the better case. You can say that in order for an individual to be eligible to be the skull, it can't be a human being. Conversely, in order to be eligible to be Hamlet, the individual has to be a human being. Or you can say that if you're dealing with a football team, the left tackle has got to weigh more than 250 pounds. See, there are various characteristics that an individual might have that would make him eligible or ineligible for being one of the elements. And so you specify that with attributional contingencies. Now, among the traditional kinds of things that fit this is anything to do with mind and body, in the sense that a statement to the effect that you have to have a certain neuronal pattern in order to talk or in order to do various things would be phrased as an attributional contingency. It says you have to have that kind of characteristic in order to be eligible to serve as an individual here who talks, who thinks, who etc. Well, remember the chess game. I said it's the easiest example. Move one, move two, three, four. Yeah. Or think of a conversation. You know, he says, she says, he says, she says. Or think of a football game where you have 22 people, each of them. You would have to stack this diagram 22 deep to get at what's going on in a football game. And you would start each play with a snap of the ball here, and then you would have different sequences for each of the players. And you would have contingencies connecting what one player does, dependent on what another player does. Also dependent on his characteristics.
So without relationships, this diagram specifically looks at relationships.
Now this is, the diagram only gets at part of what you have to specify. To specify a process. See, it's easy to diagram this. It would be hard to diagram anything of these sorts.
What about buses driving to goals? You have the options of turning left or left. What would be the stages?
Well, depends. See, the trouble with trying to give a process description of that is it's hard to break it down into stages. And you might want to just say it's one long process with no stages. Or you might get involved in, well, gee, at any given decision point, that's how you'll divide it into stages. And then for each decision, then you can maybe specify options. Yeah, often it is. Now, it's not always possible to give process descriptions of things that you're familiar with, and that's why process description is only one of eight formats for describing things that you observe. What you're talking about probably would fit better into a task description, in which you merely specify what it is that needs to get done, but not how it's done. Incidentally, I don't think I ever commented. The references in the back of your outline, there should be at least one copy of each of those in Hunter Library on reserve for this class. And in each of those references, you can see that they're referred to somewhere in the outline. Normally, the reference is that you'll find a more extended discussion of the point in the outline if you go to the reference and read it. And in this case, the reference for these formats and forms of description is what actually happens. And that's, I think, your last reference in the back of your outline. So when I say that there are eight formats for describing, and this is only one of them, you'll find the development and the details in what actually happens, if you're interested.
It's not a subjective statement, it's not what I think actually happens.
No. You have to distinguish what actually happens from what really happens. I'm not talking about what really happens, I'm talking about what actually happens. In effect, I'm looking at objective language, the language and the concept with which we say that something really happens as against being imaginary or other things. And when it comes to true descriptions of that sort, that's what really happens. Okay, now finally, if you put together the specification of stages and options, and all of these specifications, what you wind up with are versions. The versions are the net product of all of these specifications and a version is simply one of the ways that that process could take place. What all of these specifications do is specify which sets of events or happenings will qualify as the occurrence of that process. Each of these expresses some constraint on what it is which, if it happened, would constitute the occurrence of that process or some part of it. When you put that all together, you wind up with the ways in which that process could take place. And now, the connection between this and the process. is that whenever this process occurs, one of its versions occurs. So every observational thing will be the observation of a version of a given process. And one of the interesting and difficult things here for behavioral research, since behavior and behavior patterns are processes, is that the versions of a process don't have to resemble one another at all, except in respect to being versions. And the difficulty is that you normally want to study certain kinds of processes, but all you're ever going to observe is certain versions. And since the versions don't have to resemble each other, what would qualify as a representative sample of versions from which you could draw conclusions about the process? I leave you with that thought in mind. Because it's not something that you're going to get around. You have to come to terms with it in some technical way, but that is one of those brute facts. Okay, now, the connection to this specific development is this. I said that at any stage in a process, there's some number of options. By the way, I've diagrammed a special case of process, namely a behavioral process, where the stages are deliberate actions. In general, you can represent any kind of process with these specifications. It just happens that if some of the individuals are human beings and some of the other specifications are of the appropriate sort, you've got a behavioral process and then you diagram it this way, where the stages are behaviors. Okay, now in a case like that, this set of options that stems from this being the process it is just this set of options that a person chooses from in deciding what to do. It's because there are options here that there are choices here. Now, it's because of this kind of connection that you'll get certain linking principles, like every case of intentional action is a participation in some social practice. That you don't ever have an isolated behavior which is not a participation in some social practice. That's why, for example, there are parallel definitions of pathology. The one saying a significant restriction in ability to engage in intentional action. The other, a significant restriction on the ability to participate in existing social practices. It's because doing one is always a case of doing another that you have alternate formulations. Now, did we go through the clinical example of the going home and having dinner at 8:30? Yeah. Kind of thought we did. Okay, well, you can see what happens here, that having dinner at 8:30 is just one of the versions of having dinner. And when all I specified was certain of the elements of having dinner, that's all it was. As soon as I specified certain other things, you were able to figure out the kind of choice that was being made and to recognize the behavior as hostile behavior. Not on the basis of performance, but on the basis of the choice. The performance is simply the kind that you might see anytime somebody has steak for dinner. The choice was not merely that. The choice was something that you could describe as hostile. Why? Because it was the choice of serving me dinner late and serving something I didn't like. Given those descriptions, it no longer looks like just having dinner. So the kind of things that we're going to be interested in require us as observers to be aware of the range of options that are available for a person who is behaving. Because unless we know something about those options, we don't know what choices he's making. If we don't know what choices he's making, we're going to miss usually the most significant aspects of his behavior. Now, knowing what the options were is, in an important respect, not an observational task. When you look at something, you might say, you can't see what doesn't happen. You can see what does happen. What does happen is the occurrence of this behavior. What doesn't happen is any of these. So you couldn't establish by observation then that this was being chosen as contrasted to these. This is knowledge you have to bring to it as an observer if you're going to be able to recognize that what occurred, that what you see, was chosen against these alternatives. Because these alternatives that do not occur are also not something you're going to see. So the observer and what he brings to the observational task is clearly non-trivial. No, it falls into the background knowledge. No. See, for example, remember this. Remember this classic example here. So if I ask you, what's that a picture of? If you're young, you may look blank. If you're a little older, you probably remember this. There was a type of game that consisted of drawing things, of which this was a prime example, and saying, what is it? In this case, what this is a picture of a soldier and his dog going by a fence. Now, what is it that enables you to recognize and laugh? Clearly, there's nothing here that looks like a soldier and his dog, but if you know about soldiers and bayonets and dogs, you'll recognize that this sure could be a part of a bayonet, and that if the soldier was walking, the bayonet would indeed be back there, and this is a reasonable representation of dog's tail. Therefore, if you did have something like a soldier and his dog going by a fence, this is indeed what you would see, and that's as much of it as you would see. And yet you can tell that this fits. And the point of the game was to draw things which, once you knew, you would say, yeah, sure, that fits. And yet to draw it in such a way that you wouldn't give the game away. Well, now similarly, when you see somebody making certain kind of choices and you say, you know, it looks like she's really sticking it to him, what do you bring? Well, it's knowledge of some patterns of behavior. Just like here, you bring in knowledge of what the whole thing would look like, that enables you to recognize these as parts.
How do you know about choices?
No, you don't usually think of them any more than you think about the... remember our discussion that you don't match this against an internal picture. Well, likewise, you don't generally think about patterns. You simply are familiar enough with them so that you recognize instances. Sometimes you think, but that's not the primary case. Because if you couldn't recognize them without thinking, in general, thinking wouldn't help you. No, it's because you can recognize something without thinking, by observation, that occasionally when it's a difficult problem, thinking will help. But for example, thinking wouldn't tell you what a table would look like if you didn't already know what a table would look like. Okay, now we need links like this because sometimes we talk in terms of deliberate action, sometimes we talk in terms of social practice, and sometimes we talk in terms of significance. And these descriptions in general will be convertible into one another, because whenever you speak of somebody engaging in a deliberate action, You can always paraphrase that as somebody engaging in a social practice. No. You can also paraphrase, at least from social practice, into whenever somebody engages in a social practice, it participates in it, you can take any of the behaviors he engages in, for example, this one here, and say that the significance of his engaging in this particular behavior is that that is a way of engaging in that practice. In the chess game, the significance of his moving pawn to king 4 is that he's playing chess. So whenever you have a social practice thing, the relation between doing one of these and engaging in the whole practice is that of significance. You are engaging in the practice by doing the particular thing that you're doing. So participating in social practices is also convertible into symbolic significance, or just significance. Now, this doesn't work the other way around. It is not the case that whenever you can give whenever you can say that a person is doing X by doing Y, doing X doesn't have to be the name of a social practice. So it works in one direction. When you have a social practice and somebody participating in it, the participation in the practice is the significance of his doing the particular things he does. For example, here I am, I'm waving my racket around, and that's a piece of behavior. You say, what's he doing by doing that? The answer is playing tennis. Say, here he is uttering all of these words. What is he doing by saying that? He's giving a lecture. You see, in each case, when somebody is engaging in some pattern, he's doing it by doing something particular. And so the significance of the particular is that he's engaging in that pattern. So these three forms of description then are fairly tightly linked, and in most cases you can convert any one of them to either of the others. And so we need to be familiar with how the linkages are, because sometimes we'll be talking in these terms and then pick it up in this term. Sometimes we start with deliberate action and then switch over to significance. Now, in the case of the dinner at 8:30, you see, you can say the significance of serving it at 8:30 is that she was getting back at me. I recall we talked about intrinsic versus non-intrinsic social practices, where an intrinsic practice was one that could be engaged in without any ulterior motivation. And I said that these practices are crucial because all other behaviors and all other practices will ultimately be one of those. That whatever you're doing, and whatever you're doing by doing that, eventually it turns out that you're engaging in one of these intrinsic practices. And until you reach an intrinsic practice description, you've got an incomplete description and an incomplete understanding of what behavior is going on. See, for example, if I'm standing here doing this, you can certainly describe my behavior as tossing a piece of chalk in here. But you also know darn well that you're missing something, because people don't just toss pieces of chalk in the air for nothing or for its own sake. And so you ask, what's he getting out of it? What is he doing by doing that? And until you reach an intrinsic practice description, you're not satisfied. You know you're missing something. Huh?
That's like, for an example, can you go back on that one? Can you do that one?
Do what?
get to an intrinsic practice description?
You mean throwing the chalk in the air? Well, I was demonstrating a point. That's immediately what I was doing by throwing the chalk in the air.
Is that intrinsic? In other words, is it intrinsic but not for any particular reward?
Yeah, and you do it for its own sake. Now, I'm making a point as part of presenting some material. And I'm presenting some material for the sake of getting you to see things that you don't now do. And I'm doing it because I think you need it, and I'm helping you. And that's an intrinsic practice. Somebody, you see somebody needs something, and you help them. So you can push it to that point. Not per se it isn't. Now, when I do it, but if somebody else does it, for him, he may just be passing the time of day. It may not be a behavior at all. It's just a movement that he's habituated to. But this behavior, you see, the account of this one would not be that it's just habitual. And it wouldn't be that I'm just passing the time of day up here. Okay. But you see, that's one reason why one has to work to construct a description of a given behavior. There are no general principles. It isn't that tossing pieces of chalk in the air is always a way of giving lectures or helping people. You have to look at the whole circumstances to come up with that meaningful a description. And on different occasions, tossing pieces of chalks will be doing different things. In the same way that uttering the word for, on different occasions, I will be participating in very different practices. And you can't give a general significance of what is somebody doing when they say the word for. Because there isn't any. So you have to, with behavior description, construct descriptions to fit the particular case. And it's because particular cases will differ that the task has the peculiarities that it does. And it's not one of having universals and simply applying them. Case of constructing a representation of something unique and not getting thrown by the fact that there's always more that could be said that you're not saying. That you say as much as you need to and you don't have to say any more. Which brings us to the further point that somebody who gives a description is participating in a social practice in which there is a place for somebody to give that kind of description. And it's the practice that you're engaging in when you give a description that determines whether your description is relevant, whether it's complete enough, whether it's accurate, and other such things. Now, another connection. Any emotion formula will also represent an intrinsic social practice. For example, think of this as a two-move game. The mark of intrinsic practice, remember, is that when you get this kind of account, you don't need to go further. It becomes understandable. So if you see him provoke me and me respond with hostility, you don't have the inclination to ask, but why did he do what he did? Say, well, it was a case of provocation, hostility, and we know how that works. And there would have been a question if he hadn't responded with hostility. Likewise, with danger and avoidance. There's something dangerous, and I see it, and I avoid it. You don't say, but why did he really avoid it? See, it's being dangerous is enough. It will account for my avoiding. Precisely because it's intrinsic. Because this is the kind of thing that does satisfy us and does not require something further. Well, see, it's like saying, why are we satisfied with an explanation? And the answer is because an explanation explains. What else can you say? There's not a general characteristic of all explanations, and it's not another characteristic of intrinsic practices, other than their being intrinsic. But being intrinsic, you see, carries with it certain characteristics, one of which is that you don't have to appeal to anything further. And it's because you don't have to appeal to anything further that it is serviceable as a stopping point for explanation. And at the point where you reach an intrinsic practice description, maxim one comes into play. Namely, that unless you have specific reason to think that there's something further or an ulterior motive, you stop. Because you've got a candidate for stopping, and that's what keeps behavior description from being interminable and insoluble. You have a way of stopping and saying, on the face of it, that's all that's going on. And unless I have other facts, that is what's going on.
Yeah.
See, if you look at a proof and it satisfies you, you simply don't ask, but why this? You've seen why that. And yet, if somebody chose to be skeptical, you say, yeah, but even given this, why this? What do you say? You know, you say, well, I see something you don't see, or something on that order. But there is nothing else that you can tell him, except maybe call his attention to the steps again and hope that he then sees. Now, try out various of the emotion formulas and you'll see, I think, that they all work the same. That once you have this and you see this, you don't ask, but why did it really do this? Because this is enough to account for this. Now, it's because emotion formulas are intrinsic practice formulas, and intrinsic practices are what we need to give complete descriptions of behavior. This will account, I think, for why clinicians and psychologists lay such a heavy weight on emotional explanations. It's not because there's something very peculiar or fundamental about emotions, it's that there's something fundamental about intrinsic practices. And insofar as emotions are represent intrinsic practices, they have the same features. Namely, they are capable of accounting in a final way for behavior. But keep in mind that there are other intrinsic practices other than emotions. So resist the temptation always to work your way toward an emotional explanation of behavior. I think you'd have to say that if they had those notions about emotional behavior, they wouldn't have the same concept of emotion as we do. It's too much like asking, well, if somebody in some other culture thought that circles weren't round, they would give different accounts. Yeah, they would, but then you'd say they wouldn't be talking about circles. They'd be talking about something else. And a notion of emotion that leaves this feature out, I would say, is not the notion of emotional behavior. It might be a notion of emotional state or something else, but not this. Okay, I think it's time to quit. Let me think. I think from here on in, what we want to do is some more connecting, because covering the person, behavior, forms, relationship, and maxims are all of the major units that we're going to introduce. From here on in, the major development is going to be into the notion of status, which stems from the relationship formula. But there is a number of loose ends also.
Which library did you say we could find?
Hunter Library.